Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you are keeping well and, more importantly, keeping safe. Thanks for joining me. It seems, I've been saying it's been a troubling few weeks for South Africa for a couple of months now, somehow. I thought in the light of the current protests and public anger around the recurring issue of gender-based violence in South Africa, I would revisit an interview I published last year with Sia Gentile. Sia is the founder and president of Not In My Name, an NGO aimed at mobilizing society and men in particular against gender-based violence. From the time I launched this podcast in February 2018, I've made a conscious effort to let my guests be the voices of SA and not me or my opinions, but I feel I have to say a few words. Nothing summed up the government's attitude and those of the police for that matter towards gender-based violence in South Africa, the ongoing rape, assault and murder of women by men in the country on a daily basis, than the barrage of stun grenades and water cannon that greeted women protesting gender violence in Cape Town last week. The march was sparked by the murders of Uyinene Mretanya, Yannicka Malo, Lehandra Jagels and Jesse Hess. Unusually, and for once, we had names and faces instead of the too often anonymous or ignored trail of women murdered in this country by men every day. I then started looking for some statistics just to share with you about the scale and scope of the problem we face regarding this national catastrophe, and I was actually shocked at the dearth of up-to-date national statistics on rape, assault and murder of women in South Africa. One that I did find that seems to be reliable is that a woman is killed every 3 hours in this country. Every 3 hours. And I presume that's mostly at the hands of a man that she knows. According to the World Health Organization, 12.1 in every 100,000 women are victims of femicide in South Africa each year. That's a figure which is 5 times worse than the global average of 2.6. Another depressing statistic I came across is that there were at least 55 rape complaints against police officers that were investigated in the 6 months between April and September 2018. And that's according to the 2018-19 annual report of the Police Watchdog, the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. Let's now listen to my chat with Sia from last year. Yeah, it's been a while. We've been trying to set this up for a couple of weeks now.
Over 2 months, I think.
I think events just have kind of overtaken you. There's been a couple of unfortunately tragic and violent instances that you've been forced to kind of react to. I want to start, though, by just, as I do with most of these interviews, just to get a sense of where you're from.
Yeah.
Where did you, how old are you now?
I'm 27 now.
You're 27 years old, and you've taken on board this this role for about a year now.
For
is that
about
correct?
A year. Yeah, correct.
And before that, you told me you were.
I was working. So I've worked for a civil engineering consulting firm for about 5 years before I came into the space full time. Obviously studied at the Tshwane University of Technology, and I moved to Pretoria, where I currently stay now. I moved to Pretoria from 2010 I moved into Pretoria. Okay. I was born in Klerksdorp in the Northwest.
Yes.
My family moved there from the Eastern Cape. My father got a job in the Northwest, and then the whole family moved to the Eastern Cape, and then
from
the Eastern Cape to the to Northwest when they got there, and then I was born.
Okay.
So I grew up there until I finished matric and moved to Pretoria.
What was he doing, your dad?
He was a miner. He was working in the mines, and then later on got into the union space, worked with the National Union of Mine Workers. That was his last job
role.
So
was that quite a political household then that you grew up in?
It was. I'll be honest with you, it was. My father was very, very politically involved, even though at that time I can't say I understood his role, but it was more of a workers, it was more on labor related issues. As I said, he was a unionist. So he was very, very, very vocal on issues, but of course I was still very young. Some of the stories I hear from my brothers and so on, but yeah.
And your mum?
My mum unfortunately passed on 2014.
Okay.
Yeah, she died of cancer.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, it was a very bad experience.
Yeah.
But with her, she was, she never went to school. My mother never went to school, and she was a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she, those are
how
some.
How many kids were you?
We're six. Bafana. And no, it's four boys. In fact, biologically, there's five of us. Then there was another cousin brother, who we call a brother, because they took him in when he was only a year old.
Right.
So always say we were six. So it's four guys and two ladies.
Okay.
So yeah,
you hear a lot of those. Family. You heard a lot of those stories, though, of the cousins coming to stay.
Yes, yes.
I mean, there's so many of the people that I've interviewed on this podcast that have grown up in these big houses.
Yeah,
so lots of kids.
There's a big family. Mm.
But was your mum also quite sort of political then herself, or did she just kind of look after the kids?
My mother would just stay back at home and look after the kids, and it's some of the things that happened during those days and that time that made me to say, you know, I don't want every other woman in South Africa to go through what my mother went through, in terms of how she was a typical, woman who was told that you can never raise your thoughts, or you can never say anything. Well, the men's word goes. You know, she was one of those people. And
was that your father's doing?
That's I think that's how she was raised. That's how they were raised. They're typical of any black woman growing up in the rural. They'll tell you that first of all, marriage is an achievement. You know, you need to listen to your man. You need to do everything the man says. The man does whatever he wants to do. So there's, I think the setting in itself at home was like any other household in South Africa. It was patriarchal.
Quite conservative then.
It was conservative,
though. Your dad was quite political and radical at one level.
Yes. He was still perpetuating
the
violence, in a way. And it's one of the things that influenced my decisions into coming into the gender-based violence space. And so, you know, because, you know, when you are inside those situations, I always say to people, it's like when you're a victim, sometimes you're not aware that you're a victim until you move out, and then you replay all the events in your mind, and you're like, no, but this is not normal. And I had normalized it. Mm. So I always say that, you know, the way the relationship, my father loved my mother and my mother loved my father, but there were instances whereby my father, you know, would abuse her. You know, and at that time, it was normalized.
Physically abused, huh?
Sometimes physically. Mm. Sometimes physically. So, yeah, but my mother then, she got ill and died in 2014. She was diagnosed with cancer, and unfortunately, it was late. They said it was stage 4, I think, or something. Yeah. It was here, by the sinuses. So it had gone to the brain. So it
took her quickly.
Took her very quickly, within a year. Yeah, within a year. So that was the kind of setup that I grew up under. But
And your home itself, I mean, was that quite quite a tough existence then? I mean, being a mine worker in this country is probably one of the hardest existences, is it not?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm sort of romanticizing in that, so, but I get a sense that being underground for
long
periods, not getting paid a lot of money, and then living in that whole sort of very male environment.
Somehow we survived. I don't know how. Somehow we survived, but I'm the youngest, by the way. Mm-hmm. So for me, I saw everything, and I wouldn't say that I had the best of upbringings. But as I said, the house was warm. The home was warm because there were many of us. And being the youngest, you know, every time when I want something, they'll make sure that they get it. Mm. But so it was, you know, in a township, the fact that you are working means something. And it, if you can bring something at the end of the month, the family survives. And that's enough. And again, when you're inside, you see it as though it's normal. The fact that you've got something to eat, for you, it's normal. So it was a bit difficult, but my father didn't. When I started going through later in my primary school years, he lost his job. He lost his job, and then they were both now unemployed with their mother. Now that there was it. That was tough, because now it meant there's no source of income. Between the mother's not working, the father's not working. My brother had just gone to Bible school. He went to Joburg to study theology, and then the other ones were in high school. So, yeah, that was tough. Remember my mother to start sewing. She was very good at sewing. Then she would do clothes for people, and then they'd pay her, you know, feed the family for a day or two. Then my father would take odd jobs and whatnot. So it was, yeah, it was a tough one. But again, somehow we survived, and for me, that's the most important thing. Yeah. We've all grown now. We've got our own families. We've got our own children, our wives, our husbands. Mm. We've got our own homes. You know, that's the most important thing. We survived.
Was that a home that encouraged you to learn and to read and to think of your futures, or were you still sort of very caught up in just sort of survival?
No, definitely it was you know, my father would say education is the only way out, and again, that is how we are taught in the township, in the rural areas, that if you don't go to school, this is your life. You know, there's a pattern system. Go to school, finish matric, go to university or technicon, get a job, marry and die. That's how it is. So they'd always say to us, you know, if we don't want you guys to live the life that we've lived. So in order for you to move out of here is to make sure that you study. And fortunately, as I said, I was the last born. So the guys that came before me, they went to school, they studied, they graduated, you know, and their life transformed right in front of my eyes.
You saw that.
And I saw that. And for me, that was a reason enough to say
that was an inspiration.
That was an inspiration. It means I don't have to accept the situation as it is. My life can also, you know, turn around. Mm. And I'd be lying if I say my brothers were not supportive, because also the other guys who said, you know, after school, come to Pretoria. You know, they accommodated me for a few months, went to school, went to the residence at the university until I got a job and became independent. Mm. But the environment, typically the township where I was born in, it's very poverty stricken. Everyone drinks. Like, it's, you know, people drink there. And
what is the name of the township?
It was formerly called Joburton, now Matlosana. It's called Matlosana
in Klerksdorp,
yeah, just on the N12, between just after Potchefstroom, then there's Klerksdorp. The first township that you, it's on your left. That's
quite a grim place.
Yeah, it's almost as though it's impossible to make it out of that place. Mm. But, you know, we've seen a lot of people coming out, people who've done great things, you know. I mean, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu was also born there, side. So it's there's so much potential, but it's almost as though that there are no role models, so to say. But I was fortunate enough to live there. We call it the... What do you call this? The race or something like that. You know, it's like you are in a race, and then you cross the finish line. When you leave the township, you're liberated. Mm. Yeah. So that's how it was.
Do you go back there still?
I do a lot. I was there 2 months ago. I was setting up a Not In My Name branch in Klerksdorp.
Okay.
Because we've got lots and lots of cases. I receive calls, emails of people, women who've been abused, women who've been killed by their boyfriends and whatnot. So I always say to people that First of all, I do this work voluntarily. No one is assisting me financially. I've put all my savings into this. So it's impossible for me to travel all over the country and try and assist everyone. So I went there to say to the residents, come, let's meet. Let's set up a structure that will deal with these issues without me having to be there. You know, and then that's what we did. We currently have got people, group of activists now in Klerksdorp who are running, who are doing the similar things that I do in Gauteng and throughout the country, but they're doing it in the township.
Yeah. I want to get into that now a little bit in terms of the work. Not in My Name SA formed in May 2017. What sparked that? I mean, was it just you and a couple of your friends sort of got together and said, like, this is just now a crazy situation? Was there a particular moment or event? Or how did the, can you just give me some idea of the build-up to the formation of the
So what happened was, I don't know if you remember the story of Karabo Mokoena, the girl that was killed and set alight by the boyfriend. Yeah. He was just sentenced now. So it was around that time, and I just gotten sick and tired of tweeting and Facebooking, not all men are trash, all men are trash. I mean, for me, it's all good when we are activists on online, but it doesn't make any much of a difference. Then I said to myself, you know, maybe we need to do something as men initially. As men, we need to call each other into order and take collective responsibility. The fact that I don't hit a woman, the fact that my friend doesn't do it, doesn't mean that now we have to distance ourselves from the struggles of women and children in South Africa. And then we said, no, you know what, we are going to march. And our march was planned in such a way that it's not going to happen during the week. It's going to happen on a Saturday so that we can ensure maximum participation. Then people said, now, how are you going to, will you be issuing any memorandum or anything like that? I said, no, because we are not marching to the government. We are marching against ourselves as men because we are the perpetrators here. So it was a call for men to take action and to take collective responsibility. So now, after we marched, by the way, we planned the march in three to four days, and it was a success. It was huge. And as a main speaker that day, I mentioned that, you know, I committed myself right in front of national TV live. I said, you know what, I'm going to fight gender-based violence. And at that time, I didn't have a plan of how I'm going to do it. So I was like, okay, now I need to do it. But it's something I've always wanted to do. So I said to the guys that were helping me, okay, so I called two of my friends. The other one is a graphic designer. I said, I need you to create a poster for me. I'm going to march. Did the poster. I said, the date? You said, no, this Saturday. That was on a Monday. And the poster was ready. Sunday afternoon, the poster was ready. Monday morning, we sent it out through social media. I called another friend of mine. He said, no, I'm in. So it was the three of us now. And mind you, I didn't know the process of marching. First, you need to go to the municipality. You need to go to SAPS, get the permission and whatnot. I remember the first call for an interview I got was with Power FM. It was around, I was at work, sitting in the office, doing my designs, you know. I got a call around 3 from Power FM. Now the producer tells me, I want you to talk to Bobby Moloi around 6 about your match that you're having this Saturday. Shucks. Okay. Can you come to studio? Like, yes, I'll come to studio. And then after that, I call my friends. Like, gents, we've got an interview on Power FM. They want us to talk about the match. What are we going to say? And now calls start flooding in. Have you guys applied? You know, people calling in, no, we want to be part of this. Are you guys, have you been given permission to...
Was this
to...
on the Power interview now?
No, before. I went to the to do the interview. And now one other thing I did, which was, well, it's not a mistake, but I think it turned the events around, was the fact that I gave my main number out on radio. My phone never stopped ringing. And like, now, until this lady called from Cape Town, and she said, it's a white lady, she said to me, thank you for doing what you are doing. You know, it's long overdue. I want to come with my family to the march. Is the march protected? And I, like, what do you mean protected? She's like, the city, the police, if you got permission, whatever. I'm like, yo, ma'am, can I call you back? then we had Tuesday now. Tuesday, that's when we started planning for the march. And then I went to the city of Tswane, told them the situation. It was all over. It was all over the news, the newspapers.
They knew something was up.
And told them, you know, if you refuse to give us this permission now, the people of South Africa are going to be very mad at you. They said, no, there's going to be, there must be 7 days of permission. I said, you must do this. Whether you do it or you don't, we are marching this Saturday. Mm. And I told them, no, we'll meet outside the union buildings. Won't go into the buildings, but there by the green area. And they said, no, it's fine. They gave us the permission. And that was it. Mm. But now, what made me decide to start the movement? Because remember, that started as a campaign.
You weren't even an organization anything then.
No. We're just independent.
That was just like a one-off response to that particular... Yeah. Murder.
Then one of the conversations I had with some journalists, I think it was from the City Press. She said, "Where to from here?" And she asked a very pertinent question, which my wife also asked me. That so you're going to march, then what? You know that you're putting yourself in a certain position that that will raise expectations. And I said, "I don't know if you know this, but the not in my name is a phrase that has been used." Throughout, I mean, it's been used in the Middle East on other issues. So I said, maybe we need to find a way to sustain the campaign. You know, campaigns come and go. Zuma must go. After Zuma goes, it dies down. This must happen. Land, what, then people. So you need to come to have a plan to sustain the campaign. And then I said, no, let's take this campaign and turn it to a movement. Let's register an NPC, register an NPO, and continue with all the work that we did this week. Let's do it. And that's how we, after the march, it was a success. We had another one immediately the following Saturday in Soweto, which was a success as well. Then the following week, I said, you know what, I'm going to register a company, an organization. Then we registered, not in my name, we drew up a constitution. Everything was in place. And that's how we've been drawing programs since ever then, assisting people with court cases. We've been attending, we've been creating mass mobilization events, which are marches. You know, we've taken some skills, kids to school in Hammanskraal, given them bursaries through our partners. We've given women pepper sprays, self-defense classes. So there's still quite a lot that needs to be done. Sure. But that's how it became about, you know. Yeah. Just to sustain the campaign, we needed to register a movement that will continue doing the work. Even long after I myself decide that I don't want to do this anymore. Mm. But I'm sure and I'm confident that the movement is bigger than me now anyways.
Yeah,
so it will continue through without me.
It's interesting that you started off, it seems, as a specifically geared towards fighting gender violence and advocating for women's rights in that context, but you've moved now to become more of a social justice, or as you've said, a sort of civil rights organization. And that's obviously happened quite quickly within the last year. So you've already kind of adapted your direction or your purpose from how it was initially envisaged. Yeah. How did that come about, and why did you take that decision?
Yeah, so when we were involved with a lot of people assisting them with these cases, because the reason why we closed so many cases is that we become involved physically, personally, with the people on the ground. You know, we don't,
and with the police.
And with the police, with everyone, with all the stakeholders. So what we've realized with the communities that we've worked with is that gender-based violence is not something that goes alone on its own. There's other issues that are involved there, and especially if you go to rural areas and this poverty-stricken townships, you'll find that unemployment is a problem, alcohol and drug abuse is a problem. But now, if you're saying you are a gender activist and you deal with gender-based violence, but now you don't tackle other issues, then it's going to be a problem. We needed to address issues like corruption within the police system, within the justice system. Why are court dockets getting missing? Why are people's cases, they just go missing without any explanation? We needed to tap into those spaces. We needed to tap into church and talk to the pastors and say, but we need to have a serious discussion around the religion and how it perpetuates violence in gender relations. We needed to talk to traditional leaders, to say how can we start a discourse or a conversation around what masculinity means in the context of a cultural setup. We needed to tap into all those other spaces.
So many things. So, I mean, it's the whole nature of our society.
Exactly. So we then said no, but then for us to do this, first of all, we need to know our constitution. We need to know the constitution of South Africa. We need to know the rights and the responsibilities. We then said, maybe we need to go back to the drawing board and say, we can't just be a gender-based violence group only. Let's then revise our profile into a civil rights movement, and it has paid off, because now we are flexible and we are able to deal with other issues as they come. But another thing was the fact that we received a lot of criticism, especially from other movements such as the feminist movements and others like that, in that we want to we're making this whole thing about us as men.
Men, sort of leading the struggle.
Manly, how can you lead our struggle as men? But it's funny, because you said we must take responsibility. Now we are taking the responsibility. Now we're having a problem with. So, because when we started, it was men only, by the way. Yeah. So then we then said, no, let's do this civil rights or social justice movement. Let's involve
That's
all
a bigger
parties.
Tent.
Yes, LGBTI community come through, women come through, everyone now is, and that's how we've managed to do it. And then we've broken it down to three pieces. We've got Not In My Name, Bafazi, which is a woman-only wing that deals with women's issues, like the sanitary pad drive that we'll be having. Then we've got Not In My Name, Basebenzi, which is a workers wing whereby we deal with issues in the labor space, social injustices in the space, in the workplace, or anti-harassment in the workplace, gender sensitivity in the workplace. And then we've got Bafundi, which is a student wing that deals with issues of, like you've seen, there's a lot of violence now in schools.
And universities.
And universities, yes. So it's from high schools and universities. So for now, we've structured it into those three subsections. So the whole intention is to tap into other spaces that most organizations don't, because most of the NGOs out there, they deal especially with victims, victim empowerment programs and whatnot, but very few of them deal with the boys, the men who are potential perpetrators, by the way. None of them, deal with the root causes, because you can't always be dealing with symptoms. If you are going to, if there's a household where the mother and the father are fighting, if you don't deal with the reason why they are fighting, the men can arrest the woman, they can have the woman arrested or vice versa, and then you have protection orders. It's going to be a mess, but you have not solved anything, because the problem there in that household is income. The problem in that house is alcohol. So until you address the issue of abuse of substances in that family, until you address the issue of the man's inability to cater for his family financially, you have not solved the problem. So that is why some of our programs are designed at that. To say, take young people, take them into. Unfortunately, we have not received any bursaries for universities, but we've gotten some for colleges, for TVET colleges. Take young people to TVET colleges, let them learn how to use a computer, let them learn how to boiler, to do this boiler making courses. At least it's something to get by. And then they come back and they invest in the economy of the township, they develop their families. And then you've tried to solve a portion of the problem. You take girls, women, instead of them depending on the so-called blessers and whatnot, you empower them, So we've designed some of those programs. You take these girls, we place them in places where they can get work experience, college, where they, then you know that by doing that, you've empowered this girl. There's no need for her to be running around and being used by this man or being a victim of gender-based violence. So that is our approach, is to say that by being a civil rights group, you know, we are able to do all these other things, not only being an advocacy group, but also being having an approach that is more of proactive rather than being reactive to issues. When we are sitting and not marching, we are busy doing something and that is likely to be developing the next person.
Do you meet with other similar kinds of organizations on a regular basis? I mean, I'm thinking about POA and organizations that, you know, that have been sort of long-standing in the sort of gender space.
Yeah.
How would you describe those relations, and how would you like to see that sort of those relationships going forward?
We do. We've got good relationships with them. Even last week, I was invited by the Commission for Gender Equality to facilitate a dialogue on gender-based violence. And my colleagues from POA were there, Sonke Gender Justice, and others. I work very closely with them, the likes of Patrick Shai, you know, Dads in the Picture. There's quite a few of them. So what we've done with Not In My Name is that, remember, we've got no funding, we've got no backup financially. So some of the services that we would have loved to offer, we can't. Things like counseling, social workers.
But other organizations can do that.
Yes, that is how then they come in.
So you can feed in.
Then we just call our friends, you know, please help this one, please help this. They do the same, you know.
Yes.
If they say, no.
No use in reinventing the wheel as such. If there's somebody doing that work that they are expert at, then rather let them do it.
Let them do it, yeah. And then vice versa, if there's something that they want, maybe they want to spread a certain message in a certain community, they come to us and say, guys, you are good on the ground, you are foot soldiers, you know, we want to do 1, 2, 3. And slowly the government is coming into the picture, you know, there's I was invited to be part of an intersectoral committee on gender-based violence that is championed by the Department of Justice. And what they've done is that they've taken a few NGOs and put them together and with the police, with Stats SA and all this other things. So as to define femicide and have a femicide watch. But that is a request that was made by the United Nations. So I was called in to be part of that. And again, that is a good space because we network with them, we talk to them. But the GBV space, and that is a part of the bigger part of our work, is within the GBV space. Mm. It's a very small one, and I feel like there's still a need for improvement. And improvement in a sense that there is no resources. Mm. No one will ever tell you that, you know, it's easy for us to do this job because we've got the backing from the government. No one. We've worked with the Department of, with the Minister of Women in the Ministry, in the Presidency, Susan Shabangu, last year. She had no budget. They took Bathabile Dlamini now, put her there. They took Susan Shabangu and put her in the social development now. But still, even now, it's social development. She's still saying she doesn't have budget, which is surprising. But so it's difficult to work with these people from government. I don't want to lie to you. What they would rather do is, and I'll make you two examples. One with that Department of Women in the Presidency. We did work last year for a month. We spent a month in Temba. This is a township called Temba in Hammanskraal. And were invited to a media briefing by the Presidency somewhere in Pretoria. And they claimed all our work on TV, live on TV. And we couldn't do anything about it. Another one I can quickly remember was when we presented a case to Minister Fikile Mbalula. He was still in the presidency, in police last year. We presented a program called Case Closed. It was supposed to kickstart this year. We're very far with the plenary. It was on budgeting stage. Then we went to December holidays. When we came back, we saw the program on TV, on ETV. Called Case Closed. So that was it. So it's difficult for us to
appropriate without really acting.
Exactly. You know, we NGOs go to these people and then they take their concepts, their ideas, and then they implement them because they've got better resources. They've got better power to redefine them, you know, and do. But unfortunately, they are never as effective as because what we wanted to do, for an example, with Case Closed, we said to them, we want to travel around the country, invite everyone whose case has been neglected, and call the ministry or somebody from the provincial and say, please come answer to this community. You know, call
and
whoever.
And particularly is, around gender-based violence yes, cases.
Yes, that's what we wanted to do. Mm. The last thing we saw it on TV, now it was something else now on TV, Case Closed. They're showing us the work that the police has done on isolated cases. Mm. And then I said to my team, I want nothing to do with the government until now. So what we've done is we design programs that we present and workshops that we do for the for corporate South Africa, and then we invoice them. In turn, the revenue we invest back into the movement, and then that's how we've managed to survive until this far.
So at the moment, you do not really have any strong relationship with any state organ right now.
No. No, we don't have. We talk. They invite us to. They always have those what dialogues. The minister is coming. Then you sit there, have coffee, and then they talk. And then they never act. That's not a problem. Mm. So I decided that it's only now that I accepted the invitation from the Department of Justice. They said, please come and help us with 123. Mm. Then I said, no, it's fine. But I'm not expecting anything from the government. It's according to me, the South African government does not prioritize gender-based violence. I mean, it's clear. We've seen it with, for an example, with Mduduzi Manana. Mduduzi Manana is still in parliament even today.
The minister.
The minister.
Well,
the
former minister.
Yes. So, but he's still an MP, a member of parliament. So that goes to show that to our government, this is not a priority. It's like they're detached from the reality and they don't know what is happening.
And it is pretty shocking. I mean, some of the figures, I was just doing a little bit of research. This is from the South African Medical Research Council, 2016 figures, April to December 2016, approximately 14,000 murders, 30,000 rapes in 8 months. 40% of men assault their partners daily. 3 women killed by an intimate partner every day. This is from 2016. So you'd wonder what would wake up the government if that is not a crisis. You just wonder, I don't know, perhaps it's a reflection of the state of our government over the last couple of years. Do you think that might have something to do with it? Just the state of the ANC itself and the crisis in government?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I always say that, you know, the fact that They it seems as though they,
because there
they
seems to be a lot of money around somewhere.
There is, and to fund everything else except that they've not even declared this gender-based violence and femicide a crisis. They've not. I made an example last time. I was invited somewhere and said, have you seen the response on cash in transit heist? You know, very quickly there were task teams, you know, there were strategic meetings, and but with gender-based violence, that will never happen. And if you say, no, there are people who are doing this to cap gender-based violence, how are you assisting them? There is no budget. How is that possible? You read on the paper that a certain premier got $1 million for their child to go to university. It doesn't make sense. And you've got state capture, you've got all this looting that is happening.
And everyone
around
seems to be driving a car that's worth R1 million.
That's the thing. But for some reason, there is no budget. So it goes to show the rot that is not only that is in government in general. You know, someone made a joke and said this other guy was a critic of the government until he was employed by the government. And then somebody said, asked him, why are you quiet now about the government? He said, no, you can't speak with your mouth full. It's difficult to speak. So it's like that, and that's what they do when you've got a loud mouth or when you're vocal about issues. For some reason, you know they find a way to keep you quiet, you know. And you know that's brown envelope and brown bag. They just and I'll be honest with you, we've had encounters whereby we were required to make noise about things that were politically motivated, and when we refused, which is one of the reasons why even today our government has been negative to the work that we do, because you know we've met with these powerful men or their representatives, and we've refused to, you know, to. I'll make you a quick example. Was before the ANC conference last year, we were told about this high official that they said he was molesting young boys, and that we had to break out that story. They wanted us to march to Luthuli House and make noise, and then they were going to call media. It was a smear campaign.
Yeah.
And when we refused to do that, you know, everything just went south. You know, even the connections we thought we had.
They would disappear.
They disappeared.
Can I talk a little bit about a specific state structure, the South African Police Services, because there seems to be, as you mentioned earlier, you know, dockets going missing, particularly as an issue, and charges being dropped by investigating officers or by people unknown. How would you describe, what have you learned about the SAPS in the year that you've now been interacting with them quite closely, and do you feel that there is any movement within the SAPS to try and improve the way it deals with these, particularly these issues around gender-based violence?
So what I've picked up is that, and this is a confession, one guy called, I was with, can't remember if it was with Aubrey on 702, and this guy calls and say, we're talking about SAPS, and he says, we are demoralized at SAPS, you know, we are not motivated. And he went on to say that the problem is you can join the system SAPS as a junior, full of life, motivated and wanting to make a difference. But when you get there, they will just look at you and tell you, no, you're going to slow down. It's not the way you're doing it. But the problem is they're corrupt from the top. That's the thing. Recently, Not In My Name has launched a campaign against SAPS. I don't know if you've seen it. It started. We launched it in Mamelodi. We had a press briefing about five weeks ago. It was after a little girl's family was returned from the police station. There is a ten year old girl in Mamelodi.
She went missing.
And
the
found,
police said, "No, there's no problem here. Why are you hassling us?"
Yes,
and she was dead already.
Yes. And then after 4 days, she was found dead. And then we made sure that we did a march, and then we gave them a memorandum of demands. And then
at the police station?
Yes, we marched to the police station with the community. Then we said, first of all, we want those people who were responsible for detaining the family, they must leave. And then that they've done. They were put on suspension. And then the premier came together with the deputy minister of police, and they said, we told them, they must do something with that police station. But unfortunately, it's not the only one. So now they moved the seniors of that police station to another one, and they moved. So that's what
new
they
new management.
Did. Yes. So what we said to them, we told them, we are going to monitor you. We are going to monitor SAPS. We had a number of demands, you know, things like people writing their own affidavits. When you get there, you are given bad service. It's almost as though people are doing you a favor when they're supposed to be serving you. So SAPS on its own, first of all, it's corrupt, it's broken, it's a mess. No one wants to take responsibility of anything. One of the cases that we were involved in was of a lady whose daughter was shot and killed just in front of her gate by an old man. It was in 2011. The case went cold until last year when we went into the area, and she told us, now the case is back in court. But again, it's dragging, still dragging. I mean, that was last year around July.
And there was witnesses to that and everything?
There were witnesses.
There was no problem with
the arrest. There was no problem with the case. They know who did it. People saw it, the lady saw it, but now the docket went missing. Now everybody in the township knows that that man is a powerful man, he's got some of the police officers on his payroll and whatnot. So that goes to show the corruption that is within the SAPS. But we've always maintained and said to them, You know, we are not your enemies, and we're not here to fight with you. But we want to help you. That's why we formed a partnerships with a few of them. You know, the community policing forums. Mm-hmm. We've revived them because we've said, where are the CPFs? CPF is doing nothing here, and giving them money or whatever you're giving them, they're not doing anything. So in a few townships now, they are revived. They are waking again, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But we want to assist them honestly, because they are public servants. They're helping our people. So that's why Not In My Name is here to say, no, we're going to assist you, but we're going to give you tough love. What we do now when we're not doing anything, we drive around and go to police stations without noticing or telling anyone, and we spot out what is the problem and demand to see the captain or whoever is responsible for the station. If we're not taken seriously, we escalate the matter. Heads must roll. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So have you developed now some contacts at quite a senior level, people that you can phone? I'm at the sort of brigadier kind of level.
Yeah. We have even it has been even from the minister while it was still in Balul. As I said, we've presented to him. We had a close relationship with him and his spokesperson then, Vuyomaga. But now they changed. So now we've got also the NPA itself. We've got connections at the head office of the NPA. So yeah, that's what makes our work easier. It's because when I pick up my phone and say I'm going to call so and so, they know that if I don't help these boys, they're going to make noise and I'm going to be, you know, exposed. So that's how we do most of our work. We call them and say, your people are doing 1, 2, 3. Please sort it out. Then you hang out. Yeah. Then they will sort themselves out. If they don't, we go back to the people on the ground and say, this is your government, this is what they're doing to you. Let's march together. You know. And they can't afford that, especially now next year with elections.
Yeah.
So it's going to be very bad as well.
You do some mentoring as well. I'm not sure how widespread or how ongoing that is, but I'm just interested to, and that's with young boys, with teenagers, is that correct, mainly?
Yeah.
School kids, let's put it like that. What are the experiences that these kids relate to you about them being young men and their relationship to the community around them, and particularly young women and girls?
So most of these are around masculinity, redefining masculinity, to say that, you know, there are ways that you can set your masculinity, but without you having to be violent. You know, we're giving them an alternative explanation or an alternative definition of what being a man is. And I always say to them, you know, that our culture and our tradition, unfortunately, teaches people that you can make a man in 4 weeks or in 5 weeks by taking them to an isolated area in a mountain and bring them back up after you've neglected 25 years of socialization. And that is the process whereby you make a man. So the conversations are all most of the times are around that. And I always say that, making reference to my personal experiences, to say, you know, you don't need to beat up a girl to feel that you're a man. You know, you don't need to drink. I don't smoke. Okay, I drink occasionally, but you don't need to. If you don't feel like it, then no one will call you a CC or whatever. Even if they do, that's not what defines you. So our conversations are around that, but also we give them an opportunity and create a safe space for them to have this conversation amongst themselves, and sometimes in the presence of girls, in the presence of women, so that they can exchange views and know that when I do 1, 2, 3, this is how this person feels exactly.
That sounds like an important component, that it's not just boys talking to boys, but there are women there as well.
Yes. So what we do is we'd have boys-only discussions and have girls-only discussions. As I said, that the movement now has got ladies, there's more ladies than us now. So at some point, we bring them together and then we talk. And it's fun, you know, because they feel protected, they feel safe. So, you know, you're safe here. Speak your mind. Tell these boys what is it that you don't like. Tell these girls what is it that you don't like. And from that, you know, we can also ourselves, we can see that this is where we're going wrong as a country. And if we don't change sexualization of these young boys and young girls, we're still going to have a problem. So it's currently happening around schools, you know, around churches, around all these gathering spaces. So what we are trying to do now is to if it was possible to get, or if we would get the company or someone who would invest in terms of resources into that aspect of the work, then it would be easier for us to move around and reach other spaces that we cannot reach.
Yeah, we were talking just before we started now, the recording, you were saying, I mean, that you don't really have funding, and I mean, you said clearly the government response is no budget, but this seems to be a perfect space for corporate South Africa with all this corporate social responsibility money going around, that the issue of gender violence or just equality in our society would be a no-brainer, that doesn't seem to be the case. Why do you have any opinion on why that is? I don't want to spoil any of your funding possibilities.
Well, I honestly,
do you speak to a lot of companies? Do you approach a lot of people for funding?
We do, and the most common response is always, for this year we've already identified NGOs, our project. Please try again next year. So I don't want to be too harsh on them because we've just started, and we've approached most of them late last year, and also now we've approached some of them, but we've gotten the same answer. But what I've also said to my team is that I don't want us to be too independent on handouts. I want us to do jobs for these people, and then they pay us. When they pay us now, we take that money, we invest it back into our world.
Like, so offer programs for companies around like gender equality, harassment,
anti-harassment,
unconscious bias, and
things
like
that. You know, gender sensitivity. It's not much, but at least if we do that for your employees, then you get value for money, and then you know that if I pay these guys, then they're going to, you know, to assist people in the townships and rural areas, people who are not able to fund this program. So that's what we do. Like, recently we've signed one with MultiChoice. Okay. We'll be doing it for all their employees throughout South Africa.
Oh, wow.
And get something from it. It's going to sustain us, you know. Get a working space, get all the things that we need.
Because you don't even have an office now.
We don't have an office. The office we had was sold. The guy who was giving us space, he sold it for his own reasons. He's a businessman. He said, guys, I'm selling the building, so you have to move out. So then we had to move out, you know. And it has been difficult, you know, and you have to work from our homes, you have to work from hotels, you know, restaurants. So, you know, for a movement as big as ours, because we grow every day, you know, every time when you're somewhere, not in my name, people, you know, they interact with you, they want to come to your offices. And sometimes it's embarrassing to say, hey, there's no office.
Here's my car.
Here's my car.
Come to the Mug and
Bean. Remember, you said, I can come to you. I'm going to tell Nick. No. I'll come to you. So it's a challenge, but we are patient with ourselves. I mean, we're a year old. You know, that's what I always tell people.
Yeah,
we'll get there, definitely.
You've launched now this sanitary pad program, just in Limpopo at the moment. Is that correct? No,
so the collection and the drive will be here in Gauteng, but the distribution will be for young girls in Limpopo.
Why is that such an important activity or action to take?
Yeah, so most young girls, miss school, for an example. They miss school because
of
their periods, you know, and it's something that is, it can be, we can't just sit back and allow it to happen. I mean, 3, 4, 5 days of school, they're missing a lot. And if
every month,
and not only that, but also their dignity, you know, it does something to their dignity. So, in fact, this drive is championed, of course, by, remember I said there's not in my name, Bafaz, which is a women's wing. So they'll be doing it, monthly or every 2 or 3 months, so that they make sure that these girls continue to go to school and that their dignities, you know, are maintained. But not only that, to also encourage every other South African to say, if you buy pads for yourself or for your sister or for your wife or for whoever, you know, buy an extra pack for somebody who cannot afford. Because, you know, when you are in Gauteng or in town or wherever, you overlook these things, you know, you think that anyone can afford a pack of pads. But it's very bad out there. Some people can't even afford a loaf of bread, you know. So that's what we are doing with the with the strike. So they'll be collecting these these pads, the ladies, and then we'll be taking them to Limpopo, in a village called Khamasha. It's in Limpopo. Then the school girls there will be given to.
So where are the collection points now in Gauteng, so, or how do people get involved in this particular campaign?
So I think the easiest way would be to be through our social networks, everywhere, not in my name, SA, Twitter.
Facebook, Twitter,
Instagram.
Okay.
But we've got a website, www.nimnsa.org, which is not in my name, SA, abbreviated.org. There is a section there where they can keep in touch with us. That is the quickest way. Email info@nimnsa.org.
Somebody will get back to them.
And somebody will get back to them immediately, yes. Okay. Mine personally, it's sia@notinmynamesa.org. But I'm not too much involved in the project, so I might delay progress. But of course, if I get something, then I can quickly forward it to the relevant people.
Cool. So what now... What now? How do you see sort of the rest of, well, the short term now? How would you like to see the Not In My Name organization evolving over the next couple of years?
Yeah, so our short term goal is that if we can set up throughout the country. Currently,
have sort of regional offices.
Yes. Currently, as I said to you, Northwest it's active in Klerksdorp, where I was born. There's one in Hammanskraal and Mamelodi. There's a small town called Standerton in Mpumalanga.
Yeah.
There's also one called Newcastle. It's in KZN.
Mm-hmm, Northern KZN. Yes,
we're also there, and we're going to Limpopo soon. In fact, the pet drive that the ladies are doing, they'll be giving out to those pets to rural Limpopo. So we're trying to spread. And then once we've covered the whole of South Africa, when we know that also in September, towards the end, I'll be in George in the Western Cape, okay, in Tembali to also try and activate that. Say, I think I'll be with Sizwe Mpofu.
Okay.
We'll also be there. Yeah. But that it's for another dialogue session, but I'll be staying longer to do other things for Not In My Name.
Right.
So once we've done that throughout the country, I want us to move outside South Africa, you know, maybe go to these immediate neighboring countries, your Botswana, your Sadek, Swaziland, yeah, you know, your Lesotho. Fortunately, I was chosen to be part of the 200 young Africans to attend the Obama Foundation Leadership Program, which is the first of its kind in Africa. It's starting here in South Africa this year, next month. So I'm hoping that even from there, I'll develop
fantastic networking, massive networking.
Yeah, because we've got young people from Egypt, Liberia, Nigeria, all over Africa. So I'm hoping that from the relationships developed there, you know, I'll have access to other countries to enhance and, you know, do our work more effectively. Like now, we're speaking to some ladies in Sierra Leone. They've got an organization called Not In My Name Sierra Leone, but they deal specifically with female genital mutilation.
Right.
So we are looking into working together and see how we can, you know, grow and affect more people. So I want to see it going out of South Africa to being a continental movement. And once that is done, I think my part of the journey with the movement would be done, and I'm ready and prepared to step down and allow somebody else to, you know, to move it forward.
Yeah,
it's not a one man thing, you know.
For me it's
about the cause, and the cause is bigger than any of us. And I always tell the team that if there's someone who's ready and willing and who's got more to offer to the movement than I am, then I'm ready to, you know, to step out and to step by the side and assist the movement wherever I can. But this is not a Mugabe situation whereby I'll grow old, you know.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm studying now. I'm also doing other things. So I've got other dreams and aspirations, you know, other than activism work.
Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been fascinating, the discussion. I wish you all the best.
Yeah, time went very quick, eh? Doing very quick. Yeah, no, thank you so much, Nick, for the invitation.
enjoyed that. For further information about Not In My Name South Africa, please check out the organization's Facebook and Twitter feed.
I hope you found that informative, if nothing else. I found another piece of information. KPMG in 2014 estimated that gender-based violence costs the country over 28 billion rand per annum. That's 1% of our GDP. I think it's important for all of us, particularly men, to understand and realize that gender-based violence is about violence, power and humiliation, and not sex. Sonke Gender Justice is calling for a fully funded national strategic plan to combat gender-based violence. We need radical practical actions that go beyond the calls for return of the death penalty or the introduction of chemical castration. Certainly the justice system has functioned properly, but I feel that the real impact must be in the socio-economic domain if we are to get out of this morass. Men need to get involved, informed, and active. There are many NGOs operating in this gender space. Not In My Name is one, of course. Power, People Opposing Women Abuse, and Sonke Gender Justice. I'll put links on the Audioboom page. Also look out for writings by and interviews with Lisa Vetten and Pumla Dineo-Gola, among others. Voices from SA is hosted on Audioboom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.